4. Marcia Hamilton lay sleeping in bed. Warm yellow morning sunlight splashed across her bare shoulders, across the blankets and asphalt tile floor. In the bathroom, Jack Hamilton stood relentlessly shaving, in spite of the throbbing pain in his injured arm. The mirror, fogged and dripping, reflected his lathered features, a distorted parody of his usual face. By now, the house was calm and collected. Most of the locusts from the previous evening had dispersed. Only an occasional dry scratching reminded him that some remained in the walls. Everything seemed normal. A milk truck rattled past the house. Marcia sighed drowsily and stirred in her sleep, raising one arm up over the covers. Outside, on the back porch, Ninny Numcat was preparing to come indoors. Very carefully, keeping a tight discipline on himself, Hamilton finished shaving, cleaned his razor, slapped talcum on his jowls and neck, and groped around for a clean white shirt. Lying sleepless the night before, he had decided on this moment to begin, the instant after shaving, when he was clean, combed, dressed, and fully awake. Getting awkwardly down on one knee, he placed his hands together, closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and began.
"Dear Lord," he said grimly, in a half-whisper, "I'm sorry I did what I did to poor Miss Rice. I'd appreciate being forgiven, if it's all right with you."
He remained kneeling for a minute, wondering if it had been enough, and if it had been correctly delivered. But gradually, a needling outrage displaced his humble contrition. It was unnatural, a grown man down on one knee. It was an undignified, unworthy posture for an adult, and one he wasn't accustomed to. Resentfully, he added a closing paragraph to his prayer.
"Let's face it, she deserved it."
His harsh whisper drifted through the silent house. Marcia sighed again and tumbled over in a fetal heap. Soon she'd be awake. Outside, Ninny Numcat plucked fretfully at the screen door and wondered why it was still locked.
"Consider what she said," Hamilton continued, choosing his words with care. "It's attitudes like hers that lead to extermination camps. She's rigid, a compulsive personality type. Anti-cat is one jump away from anti-Semitism."
There was no response. Did he expect any? What exactly did he expect? He wasn't sure. Something, at least. Some sign. Maybe he wasn't getting over. The last time he had dipped into religion of any variety was in his 8th year, in a vague Sunday school class. The labored reading of the night before had brought up nothing specific, only the abstract realization that there was a great deal on the subject. Proper forms, protocol. It was going to be worse than arranging a discussion with Colonel T.E. Edwards. But somewhat the same thing. He was still in a posture of supplication when a sound came from behind him. Turning his head quickly, he observed a shape walking gingerly through the living room. A man, dressed in sweater and slacks. A young Negro.
"Are you my sign?"
Hamilton asked caustically. The Negro's face was drawn with fatigue.
"You remember who I am. I'm the guide who led you people out on that platform. I've been thinking about it for 15 hours straight."
"It wasn't your fault," Hamilton said. "You went down with the rest of us."
Getting stiffly to his feet, he came out of the bathroom and into the hall.
"Have you eaten breakfast?"
"I'm not hungry."
The Negro studied him intently.
"What were you doing? Praying?"
"I was," Hamilton admitted.
"Is that customary with you?"
"No."
He hesitated.
"I haven't prayed since I was 8.
The Negro digested the information.
"My name is Bill Laws."
They shook hands.
"You figured it out, apparently."
"When did you figure it out?"
"Sometime between last night and this morning."
"Anything special happen?"
Hamilton told him about the rain of locusts and the bee.
"It wasn't hard to see the casual hookup. I lied, so I got punished. And before that, I blasphemed, and I got punished. Cause and effect."
You're wasting your time praying, Laws told him curtly. I tried that. No dice.
What did you pray for?
Ironically, Laws indicated the black surface of skin starting at his collar.
One guess. Things aren't quite that simple. They never were, and they never will be.
You sound pretty bitter, Hamilton said cautiously.
This was quite a shock.
Laws wandered around the living room.
Sorry to break right in, but the front door was unlocked, so I assumed you were up. You're an electronics research worker?
That's right.
Grimacing, Laws said,
Greetings, brother. I'm a graduate student in advanced physics. That's how I got the job as guide. A lot of competition in the field these days.
He added,
So they say.
How did you find out?
This business?
Laws shrugged his shoulders.
It wasn't so tough.
From his pocket, he got a wad of cloth-like material. Unwrapping it, he produced a small sliver of metal.
This is something my sister got me to carry years ago. Now it's a habit.
He tossed the charm to Hamilton. Inscribed on it were pious words of faith and hope, worn smooth by years of handling.
Go on, Laws said. Use it.
Use it?
Hamilton didn't understand.
Frankly, all this is out of my line. Your arm.
Laws gestured impatiently.
It works. Now, put it on your gash. Better take off the bandage first. Works better if there's actual physical contact. Contiguity, they call it. That's how I fixed up my various aches and breaks.
Skeptically, and with great care, Hamilton peeled away a section of the bandage. The livid, moist flesh glowed bloodily in the morning sunlight. After a moment's hesitation, he laid the cold bit of metal against it.
There it goes, Laws said.
The ugly rawness of the wound faded. As Hamilton watched, the meaty red waned to a dull pink. An orange sheen crept over it. The gash shriveled, dried, and closed. Only a narrow line, white and indistinct, remained. And the throbbing pain was gone.
That's it,
Laws said, reaching for the charm.
Did it work before?
Never. Just a lot of hot air.
Laws pocketed it.
I'm going to try leaving a few hairs in water overnight. Worms in the morning, of course. Want to know how to cure diabetes? Half a ground-up toad, mixed with milk of a virgin, wrapped around the neck in an old flannel that's been dipped in pond water.
You mean all that junk?
It's going to work. Like the rustics have been saying, up to now they've been wrong. But now it's us who are wrong.
Marcia appeared at the bedroom doorway in her robe, hair tumbled about her face, eyes half shut with sleep.
Oh,
she said, startled when she made out Laws.
It's you. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks,
Laws answered. Rubbing her eyes, Marcia turned quickly to her husband.
How did you sleep?
I slept.
Something in her voice, a sharp urgency, made him ask,
Why?
Did you dream?
Hamilton reflected. He had tossed, turned, experienced vague phantasmagoria, but nothing he could put his finger on.
No, he admitted.
A strange expression had appeared on Laws's sharp face.
You dreamed, Mrs. Hamilton? What did you dream?
The craziest thing. Not a dream, exactly. I mean, nothing happened. It just was.
A place?
Yes, a place. And us.
All of us?
Laws asked intently.
All eight?
Yes.
She nodded eagerly.
Lying down, where we fell, down in the Bevatron, all of us just stretched out there, unconscious, and nothing happening. No time, no change.
Off in the corner, Laws said. Is something moving? Some medical workers, maybe?
Yes,
Marcia repeated.
But not moving, just hanging on some kind of ladder, frozen there.
They're moving, Laws said. I dreamed it too. At first I thought they weren't moving, but they are, very slowly.
There was an uneasy silence. Searching his mind again, Hamilton said slowly,
"Now that you talk about it..."
He shrugged.
"It's the traumatic memory. The moment of shock, it's cut right into our brains. We'll never be able to shake it."
"But..."
Marcia said tensely.
"It's still going on. We're still there."
"There? Lying in the Bevatron?"
She nodded anxiously.
"I feel it. I believe it."
Noting the alarm in her voice, Hamilton changed the subject.
"Surprise," he told her, displaying his newly healed arm. "Bill just sat back and passed a miracle."
"Not me," Laws said emphatically, his dark eyes hard. "I wouldn't be caught dead passing a miracle."
Embarrassed, Hamilton stood rubbing his arm.
"It was your charm that did it."
Laws re-examined his metal good luck charm.
"Maybe we've sunk down to the real reality. Maybe this stuff has been there all the time under the surface."
Marcia came slowly toward the two men.
"We're dead, aren't we?"
she said huskily.
"Apparently not," Hamilton answered. "We're still in Belmont, California. But not the same Belmont. There have been a few changes here and there. A few additions. There's somebody hanging around."
"What now?"
Laws inquired.
"Don't ask me," Hamilton said. "I didn't get us here. Obviously, the accident at the Bevatron produced it. Whatever it is."
"I can tell you what comes next,"
Marcia said calmly.
"What?"
"I'm going out and get a job."
Hamilton raised his eyebrows.
"What kind of a job?"
"Any kind. Typing, working in a store, switchboard operator, so we can keep on eating. Remember?"
"I remember," Hamilton said. "But you stay home and dust the mantle. I'll take care of the job getting."
He indicated his smooth-shaven chin and clean shirt.
"I'm already 2 steps on my way."
"But,"
Marcia appealed,
"it's my fault you're out of work."
"Maybe we won't have to work anymore,"
Laws reflected, with ironic emphasis.
"Maybe all we have to do now is open our mouths and wait for the manna to drift down."
"I thought you tried that,"
Hamilton said.
"Well, I tried it, yes, and I got no results. But some people do get results. We're going to have to work out the dynamics of this thing. This world, or whatever it is, has its own laws. Different laws from the ones we were familiar with. We've had a few already. Charms function. That implies that the whole structure of blessing now works."
Laws added,
"And maybe damnation."
"Salvation,"
Marcia murmured, her brown eyes wide.
"Good Lord, do you suppose there's really a heaven?"
"Absolutely,"
Hamilton agreed. He returned to the bedroom. A moment later, he emerged, tying his necktie.
"But that comes later, right now. I'm driving up the peninsula. We have exactly $50 left in the bank, and I'm not going to starve to death trying to make this prayer business function."
From the parking lot at the missile plant, Hamilton picked up his Ford business coupe. It was still parked in the slot reading, "Reserved for John W. Hamilton." Heading up El Camino Real, he left the town of Belmont. Half an hour later, he was entering South San Francisco. The clock in front of the South San Francisco branch of the Bank of America read 11:30 as he parked in the sedate gravel field beside the Cadillacs and Chryslers belonging to the staff of EDA. The Electronics Development Agency buildings lay to his right, white blocks of cement set against the hills of the sprawling industrial city. Once, years ago, when he had done his first published paper in advanced electronics, EDA had tried to hire him away from California maintenance. Guy Tillingford, one of the leading statisticians of the country, headed the corporation. A brilliant and original man, he had been, in addition, a close friend of Hamilton's father. This was the place to find a job, if he found one at all. And most important, EDA was not currently engaged in military research. Dr. Tillingford, part of the group that had made up the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton, before that group had been officially disbanded, was more concerned with general specific knowledge. From EDA came some of the most radical computers, the great electronic brains used in industries and universities all over the Western world.
Yes, Mr. Hamilton,
the efficient little secretary said, crisply examining his sheaf of papers.
I'll tell the doctor you're here. I'm sure he'll be glad to see you.
Tautly, Hamilton paced the lounge, rubbing his hands together and breathing a silent prayer. The prayer came easily. At this particular moment, he didn't have to force it. $50 in the bank wasn't going to last the Hamilton family very long, even in this world of miracles and falling locusts.
Jack, my boy!
A deep voice boomed. Dr. Guy Tillingford appeared at the doorway of his office, aged face beaming, hand extended.
By golly, I'm glad to see you. How long has it been? 10 years?
Darn near, Hamilton admitted, as they heartily grasped hands. You're looking well, doctor. Around the office stood consultant engineers and technicians, bright young men with crew cuts, bow ties, alert expressions on their smooth faces. Ignoring them, Dr. Tillingford led Hamilton through a series of wood-paneled doors into a private chamber.
We can talk here,
he confided, throwing himself down in a black leather easy chair.
I have this fixed up, a sort of personal retreat where I can take time off to meditate and get my second wind.
Sadly, he added,
I can't seem to stand the steady grind the way I used to. I crawl in here a couple times a day to get back my strength.
I've left California maintenance, Hamilton said.
Oh?
Tillingford nodded.
Well, good for you. That's a bad place. Too much emphasis on guns. They're not scientists. They're government employees.
I didn't quit. I was fired. In a few words, Hamilton explained the situation. For a little while, Tillingford said nothing. Thoughtfully, he picked at a front tooth, wrinkled brow pulled together in a frown of concentration.
I remember Marcia, sweet girl. I always liked her. There's so darn much of this security risk stuff these days. But we don't have to worry about that here. No government contracts at present. Ivory Tower.
He chuckled dryly.
Last remnant of pure research.
You suppose you could use me? Hamilton asked, as dispassionately as possible.
I don't see why not.
Idly, Tillingford got out a small religious prayer wheel and began spinning it.
I'm familiar with your work. I wish we could have got a hold of you sooner, as a matter of fact.
Fascinated, hypnotized with disbelief, Hamilton stared fixedly at Tillingford's prayer wheel.
Of course, there's the regular questions,
Tillingford observed, spinning.
The routine, but you won't have to fill out the written forms. I'll ask you orally. You don't drink, do you?
Hamilton floundered.
Drink? This business about Marcia poses a certain problem. We're not concerned with the security aspect, of course, but I will have to ask you this, Jack. Tell me truthfully.
Reaching into his pocket, Tillingford got out a black-bound volume, gold-stamped Bayan of the Second Bab, and handed it to Hamilton.
In college, when you two were mixed up in radical groups, you didn't practice, shall I say, free love?
Hamilton had no answer. Mute, dazed, he stood holding the Bayan of the Second Bab. It was still warm from Tillingford's coat pocket. A pair of EDA's bright young men had come quietly into the room. They now stood respectfully watching. Dressed in long white lab smocks, they seemed curiously solemn and obedient. Their smooth-cropped skulls reminded him of the poles of young monks. Odd that he had never noticed how much the popular crew cut resembled the ancient ascetic practice of religious orders. These two men were certainly typical of bright young physicists. Where was their usual brashness?
And while we're at it, Dr. Tillingford said, I might as well ask you this. Jack, my boy, hold on to that Bayan and tell me truthfully. Have you found the one true gate to blessed salvation?
All eyes were on him. He swallowed, flushed beet red, stood helplessly struggling. Doctor, he managed finally, I think I'll come back some other time. Concerned, Tillingford removed his glasses and carefully eyed the younger man.
Jack, Don't you feel well?
I've been under a lot of strain, losing my job.
Hastily, Hamilton added, and other difficulties. Marcia and I were in an accident yesterday. A new deflector went wrong and bathed us with hard radiation over at the Bevatron.
Oh, yes, Tillingford agreed. I heard about that. Nobody killed, fortunately.
Those 8 people,
one of his ascetic young technicians put in, must have walked with the Prophet. That was a long drop.
Doctor,
Hamilton said hoarsely, could you recommend a good psychiatrist? A slow, incredulous glaze settled over the elderly scientist's face.
A what? Are you out of your head, boy?
Yes, Hamilton answered. Apparently.
We'll discuss this later,
Tillingford said shortly, in a choked voice. Impatiently, he waved his 2 technicians out of the room.
Go down to the mosque, he told them. Meditate until I call for you.
They departed with an intent, thoughtful scrutiny of Hamilton.
You can talk to me,
Tillingford said heavily.
I'm your friend. I knew your father, Jack. He was a great physicist. They don't come any better. I always had high hopes for you. Naturally, I was disappointed when you went to work for California Maintenance, but of course, we have to bow to the cosmic will.
Can I ask you a few questions?
Cold perspiration poured down Hamilton's neck, into his starched white collar.
This place is still a scientific organization, isn't it? Or is it?
Still?
Puzzled, Tillingford took back his baton from Hamilton's lifeless fingers.
I don't get the drift of your questions, boy. Be more specific.
Let's put it this way. I've been cut off, deep in my own work. I've lost contact with what the rest of the field is doing, and,
he finished desperately, I don't have any idea what other fields are up to. Maybe, could you briefly acquaint me with the current overall picture?
Picture,
Tillingford echoed, nodding.
Very commonly lost sight of. That's the trouble with over-specialization. I can't tell you too much myself. Our work at EDA is fairly well delineated. One might even say prescribed. Over at Cal Maine, you were developing weapons for use against the infidels. That's simple and obvious. Strictly applied science, correct?
Correct, Hamilton agreed.
Here, we're working with an eternal and basic problem, that of communication. It's our job, and it's quite a job, to ensure the fundamental electronic structure of communication. We have electronics men, like yourself. We have top-notch consulting semanticists. We have very good research psychologists. All of us form a team to tackle this basic problem of man's existence, keeping a well-functioning wire open between Earth and Heaven.
Dr. Tillingford continued.
Although, of course, you're already familiar with this, I'll say it again. In the old days, before communication was subjected to rigid scientific analysis, a variety of haphazard systems existed. Burnt sacrifices, attempts to attract God's attention by tickling his nose and palate. Very crude, very unscientific. Loud prayer and hymn singing, still practiced by the uneducated classes. Well, let them sing their hymns and chant their prayers.
Pressing a button, he caused one wall of the room to become transparent. Hamilton found himself gazing down at the elaborate research labs that lay spread out in a ring around Tillingford's office. Layer after layer of men and equipment, the most advanced machines and technicians available.
Norbert Wiener, Tillingford said. You recall his work in cybernetics, and even more important, Enrico Destini's work in the field of theophonics.
What's that?
Tillingford raised an eyebrow.
You are a specialist, my boy. Communication between man and God, of course. Using Wiener's work, and using the invaluable material of Shannon and Weaver, Destini was able to set up the first really adequate system of communication between Earth and Heaven in 1946. Of course, he had the use of all that equipment from the war against the pagan hordes, those damned Wotan-worshipping oak tree-praising Huns.
You mean the Nazis?
I'm familiar with that term. That socialist jargon, isn't it? And that dernier of the prophet, that anti-Bab. They say he's still alive down in Argentina, found the elixir of eternal youth or something. He made that pact with the devil in 1939. You remember. Or was that before your time? But you know about it. It's history.
I know,
Hamilton said thickly. And yet there were still people who didn't see the handwriting on the wall. Sometimes I think the faithful deserve to be humbled. A few hydrogen bombs set off here and there, and the strong current of atheism that just can't be stamped out.
Other fields, Hamilton interrupted. What are they doing? Physics. What about the physicists?
Physics is a closed subject,
Tillingford informed him.
Virtually everything about the material universe is known, was known centuries ago. Physics has become an abstract side of engineering.
And the engineers?
In answer, Tillingford tossed him the November 59 issue of the Journal of Applied Sciences.
The lead article gives you a good idea, I think. Brilliant man, that Hirschbein.
The lead article was entitled Theoretical Aspects of the Problem of Reservoir Construction. Underneath was a subtitle, The Necessity of Maintaining a Constant Supply of Untainted Grace for All Major Population Centers.
Grace?
Hamilton said feebly.
The engineers, Tillingford explained, are mainly preoccupied with the job of piping grace for every Babite community the world over. In a sense, it's an analog to our problem of keeping the lines of communication open.
And that's all they do?
Well, Tillingford acknowledged, there's the constant task of building mosques, temples, altars. The Lord is a strict taskmaster, you realize. His specifications are quite exact. Frankly, just between you and me, I don't envy those fellows. One slip and...
He snapped his fingers.
Poof. Poof?
Lightning.
Oh,
Hamilton said.
Of course.
So very few of the brighter boys go into engineering. Too high a mortality rate.
Tillingford scrutinized him with fatherly care.
My boy, you see, don't you, that you're really in a good field?
I never doubted that,
Hamilton said hoarsely. I was just curious to find out what the field is.
I'm satisfied as to your moral status, Tillingford told him. I know you're from a good, clean, God-fearing family. Your father was the soul of honesty and humility. I hear from him occasionally still.
Here?
Hamilton said weakly.
He's getting along quite well. He misses you, naturally.
Tillingford indicated the intercom system on his desk.
If you'd like.
No, Hamilton said, backing away. I'm still under the weather from my accident. I couldn't stand it.
Suit yourself.
Tillingford clapped a friendly hand on the younger man's shoulder.
Want to have a look at the labs? We've got some darn good equipment, let me tell you.
In a confidential whisper, he revealed,
Took a mighty lot of praying, though. Over at your old bailiwick, Calmaine. They were setting up quite a noise themselves.
But you got it.
Oh, yes. After all, we set up the communication lines.
Grinning and winking slyly, Tillingford led him toward the door.
I'll turn you over to our personnel director. He'll do the actual hiring.
The personnel director was a florid, smooth-jowled man who beamed happily at Hamilton as he fumbled in his desk for his forms and papers.
We'll be happy to accept your application, Mr. Hamilton. EDA needs men of your experience, and if the doctor knows you personally...
Put him right through,
Tillingford instructed.
Waive the bureaucratic stuff. Get right to the qualifications test.
Right,
the director agreed, getting out his own copy of the Bane of the Second Bab. Laying it on the desk, closed, he shut his eyes, ran his thumb down the pages, and opened the book at random. Tillingford leaned intently over his shoulder. Conferring and murmuring, the two men examined the passage.
Fine, Tillingford said, withdrawing in satisfaction. It's a go.
It certainly is,
the director agreed. To Hamilton, he said,
You might be interested. It's one of the clearest OKs I've seen this year.
In a rapid, efficient voice, he read, Vision 1931, Chapter 6, Verse 14, Line 1. Yes, the true faith melts the courage in the unbeliever, for he knows the measure of God's wrath, he knows the measure to fill the clay vessel.
With a snap, he closed the bayon and put it back on his desk. Both men beamed fondly at Hamilton, radiating goodwill and professional satisfaction. Dazed, not sure how it felt, Hamilton reverted to the thin, clear thread that had brought him here.
Can I ask about the salary, or is that too...
He tried to make a joke out of it.
Too crass and commercial.
Both men were puzzled.
Salary?
Yes, salary,
Hamilton repeated, in rising hysteria.
You remember? That stuff the bookkeeping department hands out every 2 weeks? To keep the hired help from getting restive?
As is customary, Tillingford said with quiet dignity, you will be credited with the IBM people every 10 days.
Turning to the personnel director, he inquired,
What is the exact number? I don't remember those things.
I'll check with the bookkeeper.
The personnel director left his office. A moment later, he returned with the information.
You'll go on as a 4A rating. In 6 months, you'll be 5A. How's that?
Not bad for a young man of 32.
What?
Hamilton demanded.
Does 4A mean?
After a surprised pause, the personnel director glanced at Tillingford, wet his lips, and answered.
IBM maintains the book of debits and credits, the cosmic record.
He gesticulated.
You know, the great unalterable scroll of sins and virtues. EDA is doing the Lord's work. Ergo, you're a servant of the Lord. Your pay will be 4 credits every 10 days, 4 linear units toward your salvation. IBM will handle all the details. After all, that's why they exist.
It fitted. Taking a deep breath, Hamilton said,
That's fine. I forgot. Excuse my confusion, but...
Frantically, he appealed to Tillingford.
How'll Marcia and I live? We have to pay our bills. We have to eat.
As a servant of the Lord, Tillingford said sternly, your needs will be provided for. You have your bayon?
Yes,
Hamilton said.
Just make certain you don't run short on faith. I should say, a man of your moral caliber, engaged in this work, should be able to pray for and get at least...
He computed.
Oh, say, 400 a week? What do you say, Ernie?
The personnel director nodded in agreement.
At least.
One thing more,
Hamilton said, as Dr. Tillingford started briskly off. The matter, to his satisfaction, settled.
A little earlier, I was asking about a psychiatrist.
My boy,
Tillingford said, halting.
I have one thing and one thing only to say to you. It's your life, and you can conduct it as you please. I'm not trying to tell you what to do and what to think. Your spiritual existence is strictly a matter between yourself and the one true God. But if you wish to consult quacks and...
Quacks?
Hamilton echoed feebly.
Borderline crackpots. It's all right for the layman. Uneducated persons, I realize, flock to psychiatrists in vast numbers. I've read the statistics. It's a sorry commentary on the state of public misinformation. I'll do this for you.
From his coat, he got a notepad, pencil, and quickly scribbled a note.
This is the only correct road. I suppose if you haven't got onto it by now, this won't make any difference, but we're instructed to keep trying. After all, eternity is a long time.
The note read, The Prophet Horace Clamp, Sepulchre of the Second Bab, Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Exactly, Tillingford said. Right up to the top. Does that surprise you? It shows how concerned I am, my boy.
Thanks,
Hamilton said, mindlessly pocketing the note.
If you say so.
I do say so,
Tillingford repeated, in tones of absolute authority.
Second Babism is the only true faith, my boy. It's the sole guarantee of obtaining paradise. God speaks through Horace Clamp, and no one else. Take tomorrow and go out there. You can report for work some other time, it doesn't matter.
If anybody can save your immortal soul from the fires of eternal damnation, the prophet Horace Clamp can.